Welcome to Thought Crime and Keto Crime, where Tracy does the sleuthing so you don't have to.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us here today on Keto and Crime and Thought Crime. Today, I have a really special treat. I have Mr. R.G. Dunlop and Jacob Ryan. They are the two reporters that broke the expose on our last subject and the Pope Johnson, and they've been so kind as to come on and chat with us today so that we can get to know a little bit more about what they went through to get the story and how they got the story and things of that nature. So just to get started, why don't you each introduce yourselves to my subscribers and let them know where they can find your current work, and I'll put all your links and everything down below as well. Jake, you want to go first?
Sure, yeah, I'll go first. My name is Jacob Ryan. I'm a reporter at the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting. We're based in Louisville, Kentucky. We're part of a nonprofit public radio newsroom. And yeah, you know, we do these types of kind of long form investigative stories. It's a unique model for nonprofit public radio, but we're happy and, you know, kind of honored to be able to be in this role.
You do a great job. I've actually delved into some more of your stories and just more of the center's work as far as that goes, and it's really good. Really awesome.
Great. Thanks.
Mr. Dunlop, do you want to introduce yourself?
I'm R.G. Dunlop. I too work at the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting. Jake Ryan and I have collaborated on several things going back 5-6 years, and one of the most recent of which was the Pope's Long Con, which was quite an adventure.
Well, that's what brings us together today. Can you guys elaborate maybe on why Dan Johnson kind of got on your radar and why you decided to delve into that particular subject?
Well, he got on our radar because of a text message I got late at night back in February 2017. Message was from a longtime trusted source, and he basically said, what did I know about State Representative Dan Johnson? And he went on to say how much he hated hypocrites among public officials. And that was it. So I quickly responded. I said, let's talk tomorrow. I knew nothing about Dan Johnson, much less what he was talking about. So we had a follow-up conversation. He gave me some more information that was the beginning of our long journey. And pretty soon, Jake jumped into the fray, and there we went.
Very good. So I know when I was researching the case, this is nothing anywhere, but when I was researching, there was actually another Dan Johnson in Louisville that was a town councilman or something like that, that had a long sordid history. And I got him confused at first. I was like, is this the same one? Did he go from town council to state senate? I finally got that separated, but I'm certainly glad you did this story, because it needed to be broken out. How was the reception, you think, from the people of Bullitt County to it? Have you gotten any feedback from them at all?
Yeah, I think initially we got a lot of feedback after Mr. Johnson killed himself. And it was largely, I think, it was mixed in some respects, but I think it was largely supportive of the work we did. I think, you know, I don't think anyone likes being lied to or, you know, subjected to as kind of a con artist, which is essentially what Mr. Johnson was throughout his life. So I think a lot of people, you know, though some people were angry at the time, I think people have kind of realized that, you know, it's better to know the truth, and the truth is the best, you know, kind of remedy for all things. And I think people are largely appreciative of the work that we did.
Just one small point on that. While we were reporting the story, some people in Bullitt County were hugely helpful to Jake and to me. That's right. And gave us a lot of guidance. We had a bunch of meetings. We got some suggestions about where to go, people to talk to. And of course, we were working with people who were sympathetic to what we were doing. For the most part, they were sympathetic. But they were a key component of our ability to get the story, because they helped us get to certain places we needed to get to for documents and interviews, et cetera.
Interesting you should bring that up, because that was actually one of my questions. As far as, based on your reports that I read, it seems that the neighbors around the church the Heart of Fire and the actual Pope's House, which was also known as a biker bar, there seemed to be like a whole lot of complaints from the neighbors that lived around there. So, you know, to hear from Dan Johnson's side, what I read, you know, listened to him and things on recordings, he seemed to think that, or seemed to present that everybody in the area was supportive. But then when you actually read your report, it was, or there was a lot of people that were complaining about it. Did you get any indication from the local ABC board or anything like that why they didn't just shut it down? Was there, what was the big conflict there? I know they cited him several times, but why didn't they just, in your opinion, why didn't they just shut him down?
Well,
you know, go ahead, Ralph.
I was just going to say the involvement of law enforcement was one of the key things that Jake and I pursued, not only the state and local alcoholic beverage control people, but also Louisville police in terms of the reported sexual assault. And an important part of our story was, why didn't law enforcement do more? What were you going to say, Jake?
That was it, basically, that, yeah.
Did they, you never got a definitive answer of why after the ABC board fined several times they didn't just shut him down? Do you think it, maybe it was just he had friends in the right places, or just people just kind of sticking their head in the sand, kind of, sort of, maybe?
Yeah, I think it was just, you know, I don't think we have the strongest ABC enforcement, perhaps, and people get passes and people get passes, and then he just continued to get a pass.
I know at one point when you actually tried to approach him at a freedom rally or some sort of political rally, you actually were threatened with a lawsuit. Did anything ever come from that?
No, not really. I think that we were, Ralph, correct me if I'm wrong, he threatened the lawsuit. We never saw the lawsuit, but then shortly, it was about a year. I think it was 363 or 4 days after his death, we did receive a letter from an attorney, kind of threatening again a lawsuit that our attorneys responded to, but then we never heard anything back again. So nothing ever came of that. I mean, that we asked him, you may have been able to hear on the podcast, we asked him, you know, what lawsuit he was talking about at that rally, and he didn't explain, and we never really got an explanation on that. We never really heard much from that.
Probably just another bluff.
Probably. Yeah.
And we don't, of course, know exactly what the family's thinking was about why they didn't pursue a lawsuit, but our thinking was the story was absolutely airtight. It was never challenged. No aspect of it was ever challenged factually. And if you have no basis to sue, maybe that's one reason you don't file a lawsuit. There was nothing to sue for. So at least that's, I think, our take on it, that they had nothing, no reason to go forward. No attorney wanted to take the case, so they didn't want to pay an attorney to take a case that was doomed to fail. So they just threw out some angry words over a period of time and then let it go.
Just from listening to everything that you guys pursued, I know you had, this is a very difficult case for you. You had to delve up a lot of unsavory things. In your opinion, was Dan Johnson, and I'm not asking you to psychologically evaluate anyone, but if was Dan Johnson, did he know he was a con artist, or did he actually in his mind have the perception that some of what he said was true? Did you find any evidence to support either of those things?
I don't know. I think that's really difficult to say. You know, we tried multiple times to get an interview with Mr. Johnson. You know, we sought him out at the rally. We've called him. We called his colleagues at the state legislature to try to get an interview with him, and we just never did. So we never had the chance to sit down with him and kind of ask him those types of questions to try to get inside his mind. It could really be either way. You know, I mean, he certainly put on the public face that this is who he was. So maybe he believed it. Maybe he knew what he was doing. Sadly, we'll just never know.
It's because he was obviously an intelligent person. I mean, it takes a special kind of intelligence to be able to pull off what he pulled off. I mean, there was just lie after lie that didn't come to light until you guys brought it to light. And it was just amazing how evidently an intelligent person can either use that intelligence for good or not good. And it's just, I wouldn't have the prowess to pull off something like that. I would, none of those things would ever enter into my mind, from burning a car to burning a church to, you know, having an alligator in the back of my, in the backyard of my house, and thinking that was okay. So it was just amazing to me how he, obviously a super intelligent guy, that just kind of went the wrong way. And I mean, you know, that's just my, I guess, my two cents on it.
I didn't do very well in psychology 101 in college, but I'm inclined to think that he over time did in fact convince himself of the rectitude of what he was doing, what he was saying. And really, nobody, to our knowledge, really ever challenged him until we stepped in. So he was hearing basically, I think, affirmation from family and friends and church people. And nobody ever said, are you serious? What about this? Or, that doesn't sound right. At least to our knowledge, we never encountered people who told us that they had challenged his veracity and what happened after that. So I think he, over time, probably became convinced that he was the Pope and he was all the things he claimed to be.
Interesting you should say it just that way, because I do a lot of videos and stories on cult leaders. I've done a four-parter on Jim Jones and the People's Temple. I've done other cults in general, and I actually, as an exercise, kind of put Heart of Fire up against the 10 things that kind of check off on a cult by most psychological standards, and it met like 7 of them. So I think it was, you know, well on its way to being sort of a cult right there in Kentucky, and probably that's why no one challenged him. It was kind of that cult of personality where you have a leader that no one challenges, even if they know he's wrong. Or
and
they
he was, go ahead. He was clearly the heart and soul, because after his death, the church quickly receded. It's now passed on to somebody else. There's no sort of high profile Heart of Fire Pope sort of image being portrayed to our knowledge following his death. So you know, he was it, basically.
I was going to ask you that. I've actually visited the Heart of Fire website, the original one, that's in like kind of like the Internet Wayback Machine, and definitely a lot different than the current website that's there. So I figured it had passed on to someone else. How long did you keep up with Rebecca Johnson and exactly what she's up to now? Or is she kind of disappeared from the public light, or is she still trying to pursue politics?
As far as I know, she's receded from the politics. Sorry, I have this kid.
No problem at all.
And, you know, she did try to fill his seat. She lost pretty handedly in that special election. She was, you know, kind of running the church there for a little bit. I haven't seen from her, or you've seen her, heard from her in a while, though. So, Ralph, I don't know if you know what's up with her, but I don't know.
Well, the church was sold, correct, Jake? So, and I think they moved to the extent that there was still a church after Dan Johnson's death. I think they moved somewhere in Bullock County, maybe some kind of a storefront operation, at least briefly. But I've heard nothing about her and months, or about Heart of Fire Church.
Yeah, I occasionally will look on her Facebook page just to see what she is up to, just to see if she's announcing another run for the legislature or something like that. And I haven't checked, and it's been several months since I've checked, and I haven't seen. And last time I checked, that, you know, she was just posting stuff about. I think she was still active in the local Bullock County politics to some degree with some fundraising stuff, but not in terms of running for office or anything like that. But she was still trying to maintain, it seemed like, some type of position of influence or notoriety.
As far as cases you've worked on, where would you rank this one in terms of difficulty? Like if you had to scale it on 1 to 10, and where would you rank this one?
What kind of difficulty?
Well, the reporting partner I had with this one, I'd rank the difficulty pretty high. I'm only kidding. I don't know. What do you mean? It was certainly a behemoth of a project. It took us a long time. In terms of audio production, there was definitely more hours of audio that were collected in this project than any other project that I have worked on personally. I think we had something like 90 hours of just raw audio that we sifted through to make the podcast in the end. So there was a lot of work in terms of that. There was a lot of editing and just, you know, it was an arduous process, but that's kind of like the job. You know, there's always lots of that stuff when we do this type of stuff. It was definitely an undertaking.
I think maybe in terms of like the difficulty or simplicity of getting the information, did you find that people were more or less willing to talk in Louisiana and Kentucky, or were they kind of like tight-lipped and you kind of had to keep hammering at them to get them to even talk with you?
I think with the exception of some of the people in Bullitt County, my recollection is that most of the people we talked to in Louisiana, in Kentucky, and by phone in four or five other states were by and large pretty cooperative. Had they not been, we wouldn't have ended up with the story we had, because some of the key parts of that story were linked to people who were willing to talk about stuff that we didn't have direct knowledge of. So I think there was by and large a willingness on the part of folks and of crucial importance on the part of the young woman who accused Dan Johnson of sexually assaulting her, not only willing to come forward, but doing so in a very public way and providing extensive records, personal records of hers, that we thought lent a lot of credence to her case. So that was an essential part of cooperation that we got.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, for anyone that might be listening or watching that is interested in journalism or does journalism, you know, Mr. Johnson himself, I think, made it kind of easy for us to debunk a lot of his claims, because he listed all of his accomplishments in his biography on both on the state legislature website and his own website. And so it was, you know, he kind of created a list that you just kind of went through to fact check that list. And you go through that list, and you know, I think almost all of it turned out to be fake, other than he was an actual person.
And he bleeds red, so that's about all we can confirm.
Right.
Did
if we could just circle back for a second to the difficulty thing.
Sure.
This was a huge project, I think, by any investigative reporting standards, in terms of time invested, in terms of documents, in terms of the whole array of stuff, which it was massive. And had we not been given the opportunity to pursue lead after lead after lead, tip after tip after tip, we never would have gotten where we ended up. And Jake mentioned this mound of audio that we had. We had a great producer who was a key player in getting this podcast that we produced to the finish line and in the very good shape that it was. But you got to have time to do good investigative reporting, and we were given lots and lots of time, and nobody ever said, you need to hurry up, you need to wrap this thing up. Well, that sounds far-fetched, don't worry about that. It was just like, you know, go find it. And because we got that kind of encouragement from our managing editor, Brendan McCarthy, we were able to go find it time after time after time. And that really is what made the end product what it was, in my opinion.
Well, that's true journalism, in my opinion. And I think you guys give a different twist on what we're told about the media. You know, in present day, I think you guys give a different twist, that you are very honest people that go after an honest story. And I for one, appreciate you for what you do. Just a couple more questions. Miranda, the young lady that did come forward, have you kept in contact with her? Is she doing okay? Has she kind of pulled out of, I know she had some PTSD issues. Is she kind of moving on with her life, and is she doing okay?
I think so. Yeah, I think we Ralph, you were in touch with her a little bit afterwards there, and I think she did have a tough time shortly after, but I think she's kind of moved on, is in a much better place now. I'm not for sure exactly. Yeah.
She's a mom now, and I think she probably got her hands full with raising the child. We think that she showed a lot of courage doing what she did, and particularly in the aftermath, where people were accusing her of everything from, well, up to and including murder, basically. You killed my dad, you killed Dan Johnson, kind of thing.
And oh my God. I think
it would be very hard not to take that at least a little bit personally. She's due a lot of credit, I think, for soldiering through that time and coming out on the good side.
People had the audacity to accuse her of being responsible for his death.
Well, her and us too, right, Jake?
Oh my God!
Yeah, she was attacked pretty terribly online. I think there was, because she had, people just found old photos of her in bathing suits and swimsuits and put them up there, and it was really the worst side of humanity came out.
It was a high tech swimsuit, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Wow.
That, of course, is what Mr. Johnson said that we had done to him, a high-tech lynching, which is problematic on a couple fronts. But, she seems to be in a much better place now, thankfully. And she was incredibly brave and forthcoming with really intimate and personal details that is difficult. And we were really thankful for her for that.
Definitely. She was very brave to go up against somebody that had a lot of power in the area that she lived. So,
right. Yeah.
Well, in addition, Ms. Richmond had approached a number of people before we contacted her and tried to interest people in her story, including other media representatives in Louisville, people in Frankfurt, the state capital, and elsewhere. And nobody would bite. They just, you know, for whatever reason, maybe it was too delicate or too whatever, she just couldn't generate any interest. And when we contacted her, it was like she was almost in disbelief that somebody was finally interested in hearing her story.
Yeah, that's amazing that no one else would jump on that. You know, I don't, maybe it was fear, maybe it was the, you know, election, you know, the climate and the political climate that was going on in the time, or maybe they were scared of him, you know, but I'm certainly glad you guys weren't. And did you ever come to any opinions or revelations as to why the Louisville PD or local law enforcement didn't, why they dropped the case? Why didn't they pursue it more? I know that.
I just think that's just indicative of, you know, one of our colleagues, Eleanor Klibanoff, has dug into the way that police investigate cases of rape and other sexual assault. And it is somewhat just indicative of how police handle these types of allegations, and that there's just not a lot of, in many cases, Ms. Richmond's included, there's just not a lot of priority given to these cases that, you know, police often say are difficult to prove because it's he said versus she said. And to kind of come to a conclusion there is difficult for police. And so it's just kind of the way it goes for lots of women and people that are victimized by sexual assault.
It's a sad reality. I mean, we definitely reform on a lot of areas when it comes to law enforcement. And I'm glad you brought that. We're able to bring that out in this case. Is there any closing remarks you want to say to my subscribers or anyone else that might see this? Because you've been wonderful in chatting with me, and I really appreciate you giving me some of your time, both of you.
Thanks for looking at it with such a thoughtful lens. I think this is a really important story, and it's just one of those I think about sometimes. It's just like, you know, this guy, Mr. Johnson, you know, existed in his realm of power for quite a long time, and, you know, in a small little town in Kentucky, and, you know, those types of people can be anywhere, really. I think it just shows that, you know, these types of people can be anywhere doing anything, and so it's always just important to have a check on power, to ask questions, and to be critical about anyone that makes claims such as Mr. Johnson with the intent to gain power and control over people.
Thank you.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. I was going to say the accountability factor is really crucial here, and it's crucial for journalists to hold public people accountable, at least try to. And, you know, Mr. Johnson had escaped our notice, among many other people's notice, for a long time before we started looking into his situation. So there was plenty of, if anybody wanted a finger point, there was plenty of that to go around. Going forward, I think the lesson is try to find the time to ask the right questions and don't accept things on their face if they have the slightest hint of that doesn't smell quite right. Take a little time to dig in. You never know what you find.
I agree with you both. I grew up in a very small town in Alabama, population less than 4,000 people. And I think small towns can be echo chambers lots of times. And so you get cults of personality in there. I mean, there are lots of crimes here in the South that I could pull up that I've researched that are just never go punished because somebody's afraid to investigate them, or they just get swept under the rug in some system of, okay, well, he didn't mean to do it, you know, or she didn't mean to do it kind of thing. So I think you were very brave in trying to kind of break through that echo chamber and hold somebody in a small town system accountable. So I'm very appreciative of that.
One other point on that, in defense of small town journalists, you know, we had the luxury, the time, the money, the support to do a 7-month investigation, which would be beyond comprehension for most journalists in small towns in Kentucky or anywhere. They don't have the time or the resources to do that. They've got to put out their daily news op, or they got to put out their weekly newspaper, and they've got to write 5 stories or broadcast 3 whatevers. And so, you know, it's a huge challenge for any but a select few who are blessed with the resources that we have to get in and do that kind of journalism, because most media organizations are too resource poor to take it on.
I can definitely contest to that. I was a reporter for a little weekly in DeKalb County, Alabama, called the DeKalb Advertiser. And whenever there would be a story, it was very difficult to get anyone to comment on it because everybody knew everybody, and they usually knew both the victim and the alleged perpetrator too. So getting the time to really continue to ask questions is very cool. When you've got my editor wanting the copy in by Saturday and it's Thursday, the story just broke. So you write what you can get. So, but I'm glad there are other resources. Well, all right.
So yeah, support your local paper.
Definitely.
Support your local paper. Gives you your local public radio station. Mm,
definitely. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to chat with me. And I know that I appreciate it. I know my subscribers will too. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. If you have any other questions, feel free to get in touch with us. And, you know, if you put our links out there and any of your subscribers have any questions or news tips, feel free to reach out to us.
Definitely. I'm going to link everything below and just tell them to reach out if they have any further questions.
Great.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Have a nice day.
You too. Bye-bye.